And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I will be chatting with Connie Kowal, Director of Recreation and the Libertyville Sports Complex. Connie has been a Chicago sports executive for over 33 years. He has served in many key front office positions, including 14 seasons with the Chicago Cubs and 3 seasons with the New Orleans Saints, as well as new or growth franchises including professional soccer, motorsports, the XFL, indoor lacrosse, and arena football. Connie, I start getting tired when I start looking at your resume. I am out of breath, man. Hey, it is so great to have you here. I might add, Connie and I have known each other since, my goodness, third grade, Miss Orton's class. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming by. What an amazing career you've had. Thank you, man.
Well, Jim, you're a dear friend going back again to third grade down in Glen Ellen. And I've watched your career blossom both in broadcasting and teaching. And so I'm really thrilled to be here today. And it was good seeing you Saturday night. And I'm glad I could be on the show today.
Yeah, I'm sorry I cleaned you out in the poker game, by the way.
That's okay. I finished even, remember.
Hey, I want to back up a bit. And speaking of teaching, you were a teacher, too. And we do want to talk about the Chicago Cubs. I want to spend a lot of time on that.
Sure.
The New Orleans Saints, Chicago Sting. I mean, lots of stories that you have to share. But I do want to back up just a tad and go back to your teaching career and actually the jump from there. You were working at Mundelein High School after for Western Illinois and were there for 4 years, and you taught government, and you also coached 3 sports. And then you made this, what I would call a leap to sports administration from education. And how did that all come about? I don't think I ever really found out the answer from you.
Well, as you know, I went to Western Illinois after both of us graduated from Glenbard West, and played baseball at Western Illinois and had a heck of a senior year, made a couple NCAA teams, and I really thought that I was going to have my lifetime dream of play for the Cubs. And I went to a couple tryout camps, Kansas City, Detroit, Cincinnati, didn't get drafted, and then, you know, you go, well, I guess I'm never going to get to the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
I then coached at Western. I coached baseball for a year at Western Illinois.
Yeah, I remember
you
doing
that. I was an assistant coach,
yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't a grad assistant, so I had full faculty privileges, which was absolutely awesome. And after I did that for a year, then I got a job at Mundelein, taught government, and was the head freshman golf coach. I was the head varsity golf coach, head freshman baseball, head freshman basketball. I coached 3 sports. I took a class that all the seniors had to take to graduate, and in the summers, I did whatever I want. And I would do different summer jobs, but I said, I'd love to work in pro sports, and I have 3 months on my hands. And I wrote letters to all the Chicago and Milwaukee pro teams saying, hey, I teach high school. I've got a pretty good sports background. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a natural promoter. Maybe I can help your front office. And all my letters got little rejection notes and saying, thank you, you seem interested. Chicago Sting responded. They pulled my letter out of their files. They hired me in 1980, and they said, we not only need you for 3 months, we want to hire you full time. So it became a career change.
So it came from really many, many letters, and one was pulled out, and there you go.
Yep, okay. No connections, didn't know anybody. My dad wasn't a friend of so-and-so.
Squeaky wheel gets the grease, so basically.
Yeah. I just was a guy out there who said, hey, I could help someone's front office. And they said, we need you full-time. And I took a third of a pay cut from teaching. Hello out there in Radio Land. I took a third of a pay cut from teaching, gave up tenure. An hour commute versus 5 minutes from our house in Libertyville. My wife, Sally, and I, we had just been married 2 years, had a homeowner special house, and had no money. And I said, honey, I'm age 28. Let's roll the bones here.
Good for you. That's what makes the story so interesting, following your dream.
Yep. And those kids out there, or anybody at any age, if anything, I'm inspiration to people to say, hey, I want to do that too. And you do have to take a calculated risk, not a risk, a calculated risk. But I said, I don't want to look back and say, maybe I should have been. 33 years later, I've been a sports executive in a variety of sports, but it all started with writing letters and just saying, hey, maybe I'm the guy they're looking for.
Well, let's go with your first job in the Chicago Sting, which I used to love to go to those indoor games with Karl-Heinz Granitz and the whole thing. You know what, though? They weren't the talk of the town.
And but they did become very, very popular. I remember going there where there'd be like maybe 4,000 or 5,000 fans. I'm talking at the United Center now. I'm sorry, the Chicago Stadium.
Yeah, the old stadium.
And well, talk a little bit about that. Sure. What you did to make it build the audience.
Well, the first thing is I knew nothing about soccer. So the only thing I didn't know if the ball was filled with helium or feathers. But I knew how to promote, and the only thing I knew about kicking a ball was kicking it around the infield at third base at Western. But I went in there to promote, market, sell, and when I joined in 1980, we only played indoor at the time, and the games were at Wrigley and Comiskey, and so you're playing in major stadiums.
Yeah.
Then we had indoor added in December of 1980. So instead of the proverbial off season. To use, we now had an on season of indoor. We played at the old Chicago Stadium, and
great arena,
great place for hockey. For
loud,
oh, it was the best. And I think you know, people still miss it to this day. But we played indoor, and I think that gave extra exposure to the Sting at the time. You got to remember, Jim, at that time there were 5 major league teams in Chicago: Cubs, Sox, Bulls, Bears, Blackhawks.
Mm-hmm.
We were the 6th team because there wasn't a 7th.
Mm.
So we were down the food chain and had to earn everything we could. So playing indoor was a break because we were in the public eye, media coverage. And I then had, as the PR director for the team, had to get radio, TV, print guys to give us coverage and had to earn it, had to deserve it.
I assume they said thanks, no thanks in the beginning, probably.
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, this is a long-term thing. So you couldn't take it personally. You had to ask them what would be worthy to get mentions on the air. And I got schooled and educated by a lot of guys who became my mentors. Johnny Morris at Channel 2.
Oh, yeah.
He took me under his wing and said, Connie, I'll give you coverage. Here's what I need, and I only have so much time and blah. Okay. Guys like Dave Ennett, Brad Palmer, mm-hmm. Red Mutlow.
Red Mutlow.
On WYFR.
Yeah.
Bill Gleason.
Mm.
Many of the, Bob Verdi.
Top names.
The biggest because they were the ones that I wanted to get coverage from. Mm-hmm. So I got to know every person on every radio station, all of their production people. I wanted to learn the inner sanctum of how they did their business. And then when I had newsworthiness for the Sting, they would be able to say, hey, here's a good guy here. He understands only so much time we have available, and he knows how to give us good information. And that helped me. And then one of the things that really changed the Sting, where all of a sudden it just became one of the top 6 versus 5 plus you guys,
mm-hmm.
was the baseball strike of 1981.
Oh, timing is everything.
It is. And at that time, in June of 1981, baseball went on strike for 53 days. And now you had your summertime sport. Remembering the Bulls, Blackhawks, mm-hmm. Bears, they didn't have the summertime action they do now. Baseball was dark. All of a sudden, after a week of, hey, they're not coming back, I became very much something that could help fill the airwaves for Chet Kopick and for Tim Weigel,
uh-huh.
and for a Bill Frank at Channel 9, a Johnny Morris, as well as Bill Gleason, who didn't know anything about soccer, didn't like it, but I was able to get him out to a training camp, have him get introduced to our players, and next thing you know, he's writing stories about soccer, and we thought he was just a stick and ball guy of baseball. That gave us a break. We got hotter than heck. And then the
team was pretty good, too.
Yeah,
I mean, it started to get better as well. It was kind of a right. Nice, perfect storm there.
It was a perfect storm. And so the team started playing well at both Wrigley and Comiskey. We get into a real hot streak. Baseball comes back, but we're hot. They like us. Remember that we were in town, and we got hotter than heck, ran the playoffs, and then had 40,000 people at Comiskey Park beat the San Diego Sockers on a shootout goal by Franz Mathieu, go to Toronto for soccer ball against the New York Cosmos, win it, and we become the first team in Chicago to bring home a championship since the 63
yeah.
Bears. We have a victory parade. All of that stuff helped the Sting get in the limelight. And then we go right into indoor, and we're back, and people are excited about us. And you got to remember, we had a lot of charismatic players who had first names like Carl Heinz and Arno and Franz and Dieter and Rudy and
Pato.
So we became
an interesting coach too, Willie Roy.
And a great dynamic coach who delivered a championship. So the Sting, we had to earn our coverage, and I was happy to say I was part of that coverage that the Sting got by knowing the media, getting coached by them, and then providing them info, and having a great team that was just electric in Chicago.
And then, you know, one last thing, too. I think the indoor game, too, that was something that if you weren't an aficionado of soccer, you liked the indoor thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was a little bit like hockey, basketball, lacrosse, and it was so fast-paced. And if I recall, the games, the scores could be like 12 to 10.
Yeah, it was human pinball because the balls are... You'd have the ball bouncing off the boards, and
it was fun.
I remember some of the foreign players said, "You know, what is this? I don't understand." And all of a sudden, they're scoring four goals a game, and they go, "We like this indoor." We used to pack the place. In fact,
I was there for one of those games that was sold out at Chicago Stadium, and oh man, it was electric.
It was great. And we were outdrawing the Bulls at the time.
Yeah,
and we averaged 13,000 fans a game for indoor, and one memorable Valentine's Day, we had 19,238, we win in overtime, and it's those types of things that you build a fan base, and we were able to sustain that for a couple more years, but doing indoor and outdoor both, I think, took its toll on the team, the various leagues we were in, and even the media and the fans. Everyone does need an off-season, and I think that... you know, indoor and outdoor both were a little bit too much, and I think that helped you know, make people you know, question, hey, should we be in this or not? And I had left the Sting by 85, but then the Sting folded in 88.
The collapse in 1988. Yeah. Well, let's move into the Chicago Cubs. I want to talk about the Cubs, of course. You made the move. Was that an easy move to make then? Did that come about just because you network, you make contacts, and now you go to the Cubs? Was it as simple as that?
Well, I've always wanted to get into baseball, and here...
Well, that's your passion.
Yeah, and that's what I was good at, I knew, I loved. And when the opportunity came to join the Chicago Cubs in 1985, I looked at the opportunity and said, this is perfect, let's go. Ironically, I was working for the Sting, and we were in the playoffs, and when I accepted the job, the Chicago Cubs said... when they talked to Lee Stern about my departure, Lee said one condition, and that is he can't go to you till we are knocked out of the playoffs. I need my PR guy to ride us through. I was also doing color commentary on road games in the broadcast booth. So
I did not know that.
Yes, and so I was doing that. So
For soccer. Wow.
And
you don't know if you didn't even know if it was filled with helium at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do have the cassette tapes that you can hear the broadcast. I was doing it with a buddy from WYEN, Adrian Sakowitz. And he was the play-by-play, and I did color with him on the road. And long and the short of it is, all of a sudden, the Sting started advancing in the playoffs, and pretty soon Dallas Green, who was president of the Cubs at the time, called Lee Stern and said, are we ever going to get this guy?
Sure.
And so you imagine me, okay, ready to go to the Cubs and, you know, knowing that I've got to play it out with the Sting. When we lost in the playoffs to Cleveland, I knew that when the green light went on that said season over, I had a chance on the air to thank the fans because I knew that I was going to the Chicago Cubs the next day. I was thrilled to be able to go to Wrigley Field. And
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, this really, and you mentioned it was your dream to play for the Chicago Cubs. I would have had the dream of just walking into that dugout just to, you know, touch the dirt and everything else, let alone to play for them. And now here you are, an employee of the Chicago Cubs organization. And, you know, I was thinking when you got that job, I mean, they're paying you, and yet I was still paying them to go to the game. I mean, I would have gone, you know, worked for them for free. Tell me about that first week, the first month, the first days when all of a sudden you're kind of pinching yourself and thinking, wow, the dream has really come true.
Yeah.
That just gives me kind of goose flesh thinking about it.
I remember it distinctly because, without a doubt, because after I accepted the job and went to Wrigley, I remember I touched my hands on the outside bricks of the building before I entered the facility to go to my office to remind myself, do you know where you're at, and do you know where you're working, and do you know that since you were a little kid, you wanted to play here, and now you're working for him and getting paid by him? And I was doing marketing, promotion, special events, and I was just like, remember, you're coming to one of the greatest franchises of all time. And it was just a terrific feeling. I joined them in May 1st of 1985. At that time, the Cubs were in first place. They were coming off the 84 season that had that tough ending in San Diego.
Leon Durham, was that the one where it went through his legs?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not that I remember it at all.
Yeah, or the Steve Garvey homer off Lee Smith in game four. But,
yeah.
It's
a tough one.
Yeah. And the Cubs were in first place at the time. Mm-hmm. Things were rocking. And I was joining a team that had already started their season. Mm-hmm. So I was joining them midstream. So I knew I had a lot of catch up to do. But I also knew that, hey, you're not a player anymore. Okay, you're not here to play, and even though you wanted to wear the pinstripes as a player, you're wearing the pinstripes of an executive. And I dove right into the job, went after it, and the sports world is a fast-paced industry. And then when you're in a big spotlight like the Cubs, things get illuminated more.
Mm-hmm.
And during that era that I was there,
wasn't there the Cubs-Sox?
Yes.
Exhibition?
Yes.
Now, that had to be an interesting memory. There's really no love lost between those two groups.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right there in the heat of the fire. What was that like?
Well, the game was at, those were exhibition games at
the time.
They're
still.
Okay.
A lot of heat.
Oh,
yeah.
And there's a dividing line at State and Madison that was, everyone says north side, south side. But my first week on the job, we had an exhibition game over at Comiskey Park. It was a charity event. And like it's been for years, now they play interleague games and all that. But my first day on the job, or first weekend that I was on the job, we had a road game. And so we had assignments in sharing some of the responsibilities with the White Sox staff. So and there was a sponsor of the game. And after the game, I was to be in the dugout and make sure that we were there for the post-game awards and things like that, as well as the pregame timetable. So imagine me on the field before the game telling guys you're going to run out for introductions. I'm out there with them, pointing and saying, Bobby Dernier, you'll be introduced first, Rhino second,
Ryan Sandberg,
Keith Moreland, Jody Davis, all these guys that were on this team. And that was my first on-field experience as to being part of the show. And that's what was part of my job description is to the pregame entertainment, the time.
Did you think it was a dream?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're out there and you're looking around, you're going, I'm in Comiskey Park, and then I'm in Wrigley Field. And you just go, I remember sitting there as a kid, there. And your whole childhood.
Connie, I was still sitting there, by the way.
Well, I remember seeing you up in the 200 section waving to you and saying, how are those binoculars?
What a thrill is what I'm saying, though.
Yeah. But I'll tell you a quick story about that first game. And I've got a million of them. But that first Cubs-Sox game in 85, I'm in the dugout. And you got to remember that the players don't want to play these games. It's an exhibition game. So the starters will be in the game, one at bat, three innings. And our Cub players, they were on the Edens heading home while the game was going on because you pull your starters, and managers also don't want to get them hurt and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that game, all the starters on the Cubs had their one at bat, and they were on the highway. So now you bring up all your AAA guys that are brought up for this to pitch, chew up innings, and you had your Hector Villanuevas and other players that were prospects coming up. The only starter that was on... still in the game, deep into the game, was Bobby Dernier, our leadoff hitter.
Mm.
And it's the ninth inning. Bobby's the first guy up, and we're down like 10-3. Bobby hits the first pitch because he wants to get the heck out of there. He grounds out, goes in the dugout, and then to the clubhouse. Well, we start rallying. And these AAA, AA guys who want to impress the brass, they're hitting grounders through the middle. They're getting base hits. All of a sudden, we're rallying, and now it's like 10-8, and we're... And I remember Don Zimmer was in the dugout and Jim Fry, and they said, go find Dernier. I go, he's not in the dugout. They go, he's probably in the clubhouse. I go in the clubhouse. I go in, and there's Bobby Dernier standing in front of a TV, smoking a cigarette with a towel around him. And I said, Bobby, you're in the hole. He goes, I know it. And I said, okay, a big league player. He knows he's on, he's up in two more batters. I go back
and he's smoking a cigarette.
And he's smoking a cigarette, in uniform off. He's got a towel around himself. And I go to the dugout, and here's Zimmer with the big eyes going, where is he? I go, he knows. He's in the clubhouse. Okay. Next guy gets a base hit. Innings alive. He goes, go down there and tell him. I go down there. There's Bobby looking at the TV. He's smoking a cigarette, got the towel around his. And I go, Bobby. He goes, I know. I'm on deck. And I'm standing there now. I've been an employee of the Cubs for a week. This is a big league ball player who's supposed to be out playing. And I stand there with him. We watch the player who's up get a base hit to move the inning along. At that point, Bobby took his cigarette, flicked it into the urinal, took off his towel and walked in the shower.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm watching Bobby Dernier, knowing he's up at the plate, walk in the showers. So I go in the, I run to the dugout, and I tell Zim and Fry, he went in the showers. He's not coming up. At that time, you can see all the different, you know, again, it's 10 to 9, the crowd's into it. You got Harry up there. That brings up Dernier, who let off the inning grounding out, and hey, that's not Dernier. Looks like they're pinch hitting for Dernier. Well, it was really the next guy in the lineup. Fry just said, well, we have no more players available. Whoever was after Dernier, you go up. All the broadcasters are confused. The fans are confused. Bobby's in the showers. I'm in the dugout, and I'm watching this going, if people only knew.
And you were right in the thick of it.
Yep, right there.
The thick of it.
And every time I see Bobby Dernier now, I look and go, remember that Cubs Sox game? He goes, I sure do. He goes, I'll see you. I'm going in the shower.
Oh, Connie, this is fun. Tell you what, we are going to have to take a break. There's so much more, and we're going to spend time talking to Connie, of course, about the Chicago Cubs, the New Orleans Saints, and the Chicago Enforcers, but also some more stories about the Cubs and certain players, Pete Rose, Huey Lewis, and President Reagan. Oh, yeah. Much more after this. And that, of course, is Steve Goodman. Go, Cubs, go. And if you're just joining us, we are talking to Connie Kowal, Director of Recreation and the Libertyville Sports Complex, and his 33-year career, including his 14 seasons with the Chicago Cubs, and wonderful stories. And I'm going to get kind of move forward from your first week there. I believe that was in 84, 85.
85, yeah.
And we're going to move up to 88, and what a day that was. And, you know, I think of Chicago Cubs as being this brand, a 100-year brand, and the brand changed a little bit on that date. And what are we talking about here, Connie?
Well, it's the probably one of the most famous dates in Chicago sports history, because 8-8-88 was the day that the Cubs in at Wrigley Field. Wrigley Field became the last Major League Baseball ballpark to have lights on their stadium. And it was a big deal. As you said, it changed the Cubs forever. And it was something that had been long in the making, but I was privileged to be there when this all was put together. So I was part of the inner circle as to the whole aspect of the lights. And then on the marketing promotion end, it was a question of, okay, how do we take this and now maximize it to benefit the Cubs, Tribune Company, Cub fans, a moment in history, and it became a big deal. And John McDonough.
Can we, before we go to that, I just want to ask you real quick, to get to that point, though, pitchforks, things like that going on? I mean, there were some people were a little upset about that, too.
Yeah, there was neighbors that you had to take into consideration with this. And you got to remember, too, Jim, that P.K. Wrigley, when he owned the Cubs in the 40s, had plans for lights. And then when the war happened, he donated the steel to the U.S. Navy to help the war effort.
That's right.
So
yes,
it wasn't, because a lot of ballparks.
I took that tour, and that's right. I remember recalling that now.
So while the first night game was at Crosley Field in Cincinnati way back in the 30s and all that, every ballpark was saying night baseball is good for the fans and provides better time frames for people to come. Well, the nighttime plans were shelved with World War II, and the P.K. Wrigley plans of lights weren't brought up again. Then all of a sudden there were whispers on this and that, but it really manifested itself in 1984. Post-game or postseason, Cubs-Padres. Cubs were to have three home games, Padres two, but because of TV, Major League Baseball said Cubs get two home games, the first two, Padres will get the final three, and that last pivotal game five, which should have been at Wrigley Field, couldn't be at Wrigley Field because of lights and network requirements, and hence that advantage went to San Diego. And that, I think, pushed it over the top to where Tribune, Cubs, players, management, everybody said, we have to get lights. This is crazy. And, you know, we can't give up home field advantage because we don't have lights.
You know, that gets lost.
until you just mentioned that, I forgot all about that.
And Dallas Green.
It's huge.
Oh, huge. And Dallas,
you can't imagine a team doing that today, you know, giving up a home court advantage or home field advantage.
No, and Dallas Green was president at the time and obviously disappointed as all get out because of the 84 loss to the Padres, one game from the World Series. And Dallas really took it to the neighbors and said, we're going to get lights. And Tribune Company said, you know what, we need to be, we need to have a better plan than forcing it down the neighbors' throats. If we do get lights, they're going to be our neighbors anyway. And it started a conciliatory process of negotiations with the neighbors that allowed the Cubs to get lights at Wrigley Field. And the neighbors were able to gain some things that were beneficial to them, preferred parking, extra play lots for kids, police barricades for parking and other courtesies. And I remember working closely with the community to be able to build good relations with schools and principals and others and do what the Cubs should do, and that is be a good neighbor. And obviously, the lights were an ulterior motive, but lights were going to happen anyway, but let's do it where we can have peaceful coexistence. And as soon as that was granted and passed the city ordinance and it was allowed, the very next day, Major League Baseball awarded the 1990 All-Star Game to the Cubs in Wrigley Fields so it could be telecast at night. And we were lucky enough in 1989 to win the division. All of this happened in that 2-3 year window, but the lights in the first night game I remembered vividly because
let's go back to 8-8-88 then. Yeah, you were going to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and John McDonough, who, by the way, that's how I got my start in sports, and I was going to save it till the end of the broadcast, but remember I wrote the letters to all the teams and all that? John had done a similar thing, got hired by the Chicago Sting, was allowed to hire some people, pulled my name and my letters and my resumes out of a file, didn't know me at all, and saw that I was, you know, like him, 27, 28 years old, looking to get into sports. He was working at Avis Rent-A-Car and wanted to be a sports executive, pulls my name out of a hat, says, hey, this guy could be good, interviews me, hires me. He then, after we worked together at the Sting, goes to the Cubs and says, I've got an opening here, you want to come over here? And that's because of John McDonough. I owe my sports career and my start and my training, and as well as my camaraderie of working with great people, to John McDonough, who now is the president of the Blackhawks.
Yeah, I think he's done okay, huh?
He's done quite well. He's one of the most gifted executives in sports. And Jay Blunk, who is his right-hand man, Jay was my intern with the Chicago Cubs. That's how I first met Jay. He was working for me and John in the marketing department. But going back to 8888, and by the way, Jay Blunk does a great job. I'm so proud of him. But going back to 8888, John and I probably put in like 70 consecutive days of working. You got to remember, we're playing a season. We have home games, but we have the planning for this big game. And it was the most incredible anticipated game in the history. It was the hardest ticket to get in Chicago.
The Phillies, wasn't it?
It was against the Phillies. Yeah. And we had a special opening night hat that was going to be given to every fan to wear. We found the oldest Cubs season ticket holder to hit the button to light the lights.
Oh, my goodness. I remember that.
We had Billy and Billy Williams and Ernie Banks, two Hall of Fame players who would throw out the first pitch. We had a symphony orchestra play before the game. we had all of these things that were going to make the night special, and it was. And it was awesome, and I'll never forget being in the dugout.
I bet you heard this often. It was electric?
It was electric, exactly. And the timetable and the pregame ceremonies that all I had scripted out for that game came off perfectly. Jack Brickhouse was my master of ceremonies. Wayne Messmer sang the anthem. Everything was incredible. And I had one instruction from our executives up at Wrigley Field, and that was that first ball that is thrown to start the game, make sure you get that ball because that ball goes to Cooperstown. So I remained in the dugout. Normally, I would leave the dugout after the anthem was done and the umpires were ready to start the game and the Cubs took the field. I knew that the game was in the hands of the umps and go to my office and leave the dugout. I stayed in the dugout to make sure I got that ball, and I had the bat boy trained to say, you go out there, the umpire knows, the catcher will give you the ball, you give it to me, and I go up to the other upper offices and hand the ball to, so we can go to Cooperstown. That first pitch by Rick Sutcliffe, I still don't remember seeing the pitch because of all the flash bulbs that went off. It was totally electric, and it was one of those moments. And Sut, to this day, he's not sure where the ball's location was.
Oh, my gosh. I'm just, again, it was a magical night. And it did, you know, did you ever think, though, that it would go to the point where it was supposed to be kind of a few occasional night games, and it's got to the point getting a day game is a pretty big event now.
Yeah, and it's a needed thing. It started with 8 night games, then it went to 15 per the ordinance with the
There was an ordinance then. 8 games the first year?
And
there, okay.
And it was the neighbors involved and all that. Then goes up to 30 and then some more. And again, all baseball. But now you have many more games and usage of the light, including things like concerts with McCartney and Billy Joel and things that happen. So the usage of the lights is, again, a cooperative affair with the city of Chicago, the residents in the neighborhood, and for the Cubs to be able to have the most attractive games for broadcast purposes as well as for fans to attend, because people do have jobs during the day many times that they can't get to the ballpark. One other note on the 8888. After the game was started and all the, again, we've been working 60, 70 days in a row to get ready for the details of this night. I go back and I'm with John McDonough. We're in our offices and we looked at each other and he goes, Connie, we pulled it off. Everything turned out great. We high five. And at that moment, I don't know why I said it, but I said, all we need is 4.5 or 5 innings to make it official. And at that time...
What a minor point,
yeah,
when you think about it.
Small detail. And, you know, we had always worked with, you know, the rain delays or whatever that may occur. But with this one, okay, it was different. And at that time, you didn't have computers to look up weather reports. And I think we might have turned on BBM to hear the traffic and weather on the 8s. And they said it was raining from O'Hare Airport to Wyoming. I mean, it was going to come in, and it wasn't going to go away. And we look at Sut on the mound, and Sut, who's got very deliberate, and he's shaking signs off. We are yelling at our TV sets, will you hurry up and throw the ball? And as everybody knows, 2.5, 3 innings into the game, it rained, never stopped, and we had to then play another night game the next night, which was our backup night. But it was an incredible night, and then you had the guests up talking to Harry in the broadcast booth. Bill Murray's up there. And with the rain being as hard as it was, people got stuck in spots, and we couldn't get guests up to the broadcast booth fast enough because there were clogged concourses. And it just added to the whole, you know, craziness of the night, one night that you'll never, ever experience ever again. And I was privileged to be a part of the planning, the implementation, as well as all the stuff behind the scenes. It was a memorable night.
And like you said, then, that led to the 1990 MLB All-Star Game. Now, that had to be a thrill because now you're seeing not just stars from the Cubs, but the All-Stars from all over the league.
Yeah.
And now here they are at Wrigley Field.
A couple things happened when the city of Chicago and the neighbors in Wrigley Field came to the agreement that lights would be installed. One thing was the All-Star Game being announced by Major League Baseball for 1990. And the other thing was, now that there were lights going on Wrigley, and there was permanency to the Cubs staying at Wrigley, the very next offseason, skyboxes and a new press box were built. So the 1989 season, now we had skyboxes in preparation of the All-Star Game, but we also had skyboxes for 1989. So we had this marketing advantage. We had this extra seating advantage. We had this corporate amenity advantage. And we're getting ready for the 1990 All-Star Game with all these extra skyboxes. And wouldn't you know it, the 89 season was the boys of Zimmer. We surprised the world with Mitch Williams and Jerome Walton and Joe Girardi and the great years of Andre Dawson and everybody. And the boys of Zimmer win the division. So we have this first night game in 88. We have this division title of 89, All-Star Game in 90. Back to back to back, and it just was a marketing, just incredibly great gift that we had to be able to market the Cubs at that time.
Well, it was a tough ticket to get.
Very tough.
I mean, just any game was very, very tough.
Yep.
I mean, in a way, you were in marketing, but the marketing kind of took care of itself for a while after that, didn't it?
Well, actually, what you do is if you have that advantage, you then take advantage of it and enhance it. You don't take your foot off the gas pedal and say, all right, hey, everybody knows this, tickets are selling easier. It gave you an opportunity to do many, many, many more things that you couldn't do before. And that's the one thing.
Such as? What do you mean?
Well, first of all, you can expand your promotional event dates. You can then also take your brand and use it. We had the biggest key in the world, the Chicago Cubs, and then we had all of these great things happening to our franchise. It gave us the ability to walk into corporate offices and say, would you like to sponsor events? Would you like to promote ticket packages? Would you like to buy a suite? The Cubs convention, which John McDonough authored that, I got to implement that the very first year.
Ironic. What year did that start then?
That was 1986.
Okay.
And that our first ever Cubs convention was the weekend after the Bears won the Super Bowl and 3 days after their big parade down LaSalle Street. Mm-hmm. We have
freezing cold, I remember.
Yeah, and we're selling baseball in January, and we weren't sure if we'd pull it off. Well, all of a sudden, the second annual, the third annual, the fourth annual became instant sellouts. Why? We took that energy of the Cubs and marketed it every way we could.
And well, plus you were doing concerts then, too.
No, not at that time.
Well, I thought with the lights, that was part of the deal.
No. At that time, it was 8 night games, and then you got to have 15, and then it graduated from there. But at the time, it was just baseball
only. It took a while to get to the concerts then.
Exactly. Okay. And but it gave us the opportunity to be creative and to do things and to promote the Cubs in ways never deemed possible before. And we also had people calling us and saying, I've got an idea for you. And that helped. And so John and I were able to take all of this interest in the Cubs and enhance the marketing, leverage the marketing to make the brand of the Cubs and attending a Cubs game second to none. And that really, really was a big moment in the growth of the Cubs franchise.
Well, I guess even President Reagan dropped by, huh?
Yes, he did. In fact, he was one of the guys that was on the list of who should throw out the first ball at 8888. And there was a long list of potential people. And it ended up being Billy Williams and Ernie Banks. Mm. But Ronald Reagan was president at the time, who, as many people know, broadcast Cub games in Des Moines as a youngster when he was launching into his career.
Now, there's stories about that whole thing with the ticker tape breaking down and another foul ball that went on. I mean, he was had a gift for gab, no doubt about it.
He was a pro, broadcaster, besides a great actor and then a great president.
Right.
So instead of having him come 8888, he came the last weekend series of the year in 88 because he was in his last year of office and he was going to exit the White House in January of 1989 and wanted to come to Wrigley. So he threw out the first pitch on a Friday.
Did he make it to home plate?
Yes, he did, because our catcher at the time was told, that ball better be caught, otherwise you're going to be you're going to be catching Double A Siberia. Make the president look good. And we didn't know the president was coming that day. Only two or three people in the Cubs organization, I think our president, Don Grinesco, knew, but everyone else didn't know until 10:30, and then we were all brought in to say, adjust your timetables, adjust everything you're doing. The president is coming to this game. And Wrigley Field got shut down at 1 o'clock. You couldn't get in because of security. And my timetable of first pitches and all those things had to be done by a certain time. Mm. And I was told, you'll know when we start the game, when the president arrives. And I remember there were like maybe 7 to 8 government vehicles, limos, security things that came in through the door off Waveland Avenue, and they pulled inside the concourse of Wrigley Field, which had been cleared out. Fans were in, and they cleared out the concourses, and all the cars came in, all the doors opened up like you would see on TV. Reagan got out, went into the clubhouse door downstairs, practiced throwing pitches down there to Jody Davis. And then
he
threw a couple down there from what the players told me. And they said he let one that hit the ceiling on the first one and had to get loose. But he's wearing a bulletproof vest,
right.
Puts on a Cubs jacket, comes up the steps. And Wayne Messmer, our PA announcer, his only words to the fans who did not know that this was taking place. They had no idea. Why is the game not starting? It's 1:35. What's going on? Mm-hmm. At that time, Wayne Messmer, as the president came onto the field, said, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States. And everybody in the stands was like, you got to be. And there's Ronald Reagan walking out, waving to the crowd.
Oh, yeah. I do remember the video of that. It was really touching.
It was unbelievable.
Plus and his connection with the Cubs, too.
And Sutcliffe is now warming up in the bullpen with the late Johnny Oates, one of our coaches. And he sent a ball boy down to say, when is this game going to start? Because we're all waiting for. And I told the guys, we'll start when President Reagan gets here, unless you want to start early, and then you may be, you know, traded to Alaska or something. But I was able to shake hands with the president, get a picture of it, and he signed the photo to me before he exited the White House, and it's one of my most precious things. To Connie, best wishes, Ronald Reagan.
I tell you, Connie, you know, I teased the Pete Rose. I wanted to talk about him. Huey Lewis, didn't even get to it. We will, though. We will. More with Connie Kowal right after this. And that, of course, is John Fogerty. That's called Center Field. And apropos, because we're talking to Connie Kowal about the Chicago Cubs and his sports career, amazing career that he's had in front office positions. Connie, of course, is the Director of Recreation in the Libertyville Sports Complex, which I do want to talk about before we go, Connie. But we had talked about Pete Rose. Actually, we were talking about many of the people you've met, President Reagan and so on and so forth, and I had said before the other break, your connection with Pete Rose. Let's talk a little bit about that, because you were there on a very memorable time.
Yes, I was, and you know, growing up playing baseball and loving baseball, my three favorite players were Ernie Banks because of his Cubs playing and being a Chicago kid and his loyalty. He only played with one team, the Cubs. Mickey Mantle of the legendary Yankees, who was one of the greatest players of all time, and Pete Rose, who I thought was the greatest overachiever. He didn't have a lot of the physical attributes. So I had a chance to meet Pete Rose in September of 1985, and it was a Sunday, opening day for the Bears at Soldier Field, but it was at a time when Pete Rose was chasing Ty Cobb, and he actually was one hit behind Ty Cobb going to that Sunday game at Wrigley Field. And at the time, Pete Rose was the manager and player of the Cincinnati Reds.
How thrilling.
So I had a chance to go pregame into the manager's office because one of our people in the Cubs front office, Jeff Odenwald, used to work for the Reds, knew Pete, and said, Connie, would you like to meet Pete? And I said, of course. And I went down with John McDonough, Scott Nickel, and a couple other, Bill Galante, and went down there and to meet Pete Rose and get autographed baseballs and talk to him. Pete was only hitting left-handed at the time against righties. And that day, Steve Trout, a left-handed pitcher, was pitching for the Cubs. So Pete wasn't going to play. So all the media knew that.
He took himself out of the lineup.
Because he was only hitting exclusively against righties, and Trout, a lefty, was pitching. So we went down there. Pete knew he wasn't playing. He'd be a manager. And that happened, you know, in his player-manager role. And while we're talking to him, we get autographs and all these things and pose for photos and all this. About an hour later, maybe 10:30, 11 in the morning, we find out that Steve Trout hurt himself. I think he used to ride his bike to the games. And he hurt himself, fell off his bike, whatever. The Cubs would not have him pitching. They go to Reggie Patterson, a righty. That meant Rose was playing. The same Pete Rose who earlier in the manager's office was, you know, relaxed and ready to win the game for the Reds. Now the lineup changed. He's in the lineup. He's one hit away. And the whole city was veered on Pete Rose, who we had a chance to spend time with earlier in the day. A great guy, legendary player. And that day, he got a hit to tie Pete Rose, and now every camera crew in Chicago went from Soldier Field Bears opener against the Buccaneers to Wrigley Field to witness history.
Oh, yeah. Ty Cobb, I mean, that was there forever and ever.
4,192 hits, and Rose had two more at-bats. One of them was late in the eighth inning off of Lee Smith. He didn't get that tie-breaking hit. The next night, he got the game. He got the legendary hit record off Eric Schau at Riverfront Stadium in front of his hometown fans. But the day before, he was at Wrigley, and I was able to spend time with one of my favorite players prior to the game and then watch him tie it, and it was such a thrill. And later on, when the Reds came back, he actually signed some photos that were taken of his swing and all that, and he had on our scoreboard, Ty Cobb, 4,192 hits, Pete Rose, 4,192 hits. And he signed it, Connie, best wishes, Pete Rose, and it was just a special day.
You know, I always admired him as a kid because if he got a walk.
Charlie Hustle.
Yep, run. Yep. I mean, you know, real old school.
Yep.
And, you know, we could go and talk about the Hall of Fame with him, and but you have met other Hall of Famers, recent one.
Yeah.
Greg Maddux.
Yeah, Greg was a young pitcher when I was with the Cubs, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of Hall of Fame caliber players who actually made it, as well as broadcasters in my career. Greg Maddux, when he was a second-year player with the Cubs, I took him golfing to Butler National during the All-Star break, and a lot of the young players, they don't know what to do at the All-Star break. The veterans would go away and get out of town for 5 days, and I asked Greg, you like to play golf. You want to play golf during the break? And he goes, I'd love it.
Now, how old was Maddux at the time?
He must have been 22, 23, but he was a young thing. He was either 87 or 88, All-Star break. And he said, yeah, it'd be great. Can we bring Damon Berryhill, my catching friend, young kid, along with us? And I said, sure. And Bill Schmidt, an executive with Gatorade, one of our sponsors, set me up to play Butler National and said, yeah, take him out there and sign everything and all that. I take Greg out. We play golf, him, me, and Damon Berryhill at Butler National, legendary golf course where the Western Open was played, you know, many years. And we were 2 weeks after the play of the Western Open, so it was set up great. And we got done, had a great time. And a couple days later, when the team was getting back to the start of the second half of the season, Greg pulled me over in the clubhouse when I was delivering some notes to the players. And he goes, that was really great. I really enjoyed that. Thank you so much. And I said, it was my pleasure. He goes, I get a lot of money because of my Wilson glove contract. And I noticed your clubs were sort of old. And I said, hey, I did better than you. Don't give me this junk about my clubs being old. He goes, no, no. He goes, I just wanted to say thanks. And I said, you don't have to, Mad Dog. Don't worry about it. 2 weeks later, I had a brand new set of Wilson Ultras on my desk at Wrigley as his gratitude for me taking him golfing. And at that young age, you could tell that this guy not only was going to be a great pitcher, but he was a great person. He had, you could tell, control of his pitches. He also had control of his people skills. This guy was special. And you can tell he was raised right. So for him to get the great success he had in his career, it's well-deserved to Greg Maddux because he was a great person at a young age and developed into a Hall of Fame pitcher. And by the way, those clubs that are over 25 years old, I still use them. I can't part with them. I don't have any modern technology in my bag. I play with clubs that Greg Maddux gave me.
Still.
And I'm a 6 handicap. And
a couple hole-in-ones in there, too.
And a couple hole-in-ones, but those are my Greg Maddux clubs given to me by him. I can't part with them.
And here we go. We fast forward now to 2014, and he's a first ballot
Hall of Famer and one of the greatest pitchers of all time. But
and
a great guy.
Yeah.
And that's what Cub fans need to know. He's a great guy and a tenacious competitor, but a wonderful person, raised right. And we've had a lifetime friendship.
Tell you what, Connie, we just have a minute left, and I did want to talk about your current job a little bit about the Libertyville Sports Complex. What's that have to offer? What are some events coming up?
Be happy to tell you. and by the way, if this is something that your listeners enjoy, if I'm privileged enough to come back for Connie Kowal round two, I have more stories and we can talk. But
I would love that.
I got New Orleans Saints stories when I worked down there during Katrina. Vince McMahon with the XFL.
Oh, I know.
Chip Ganassi and Motor Speedway. A lot of things behind the scenes, but I'm at the Libertyville Sports Complex as their director, and it's a great facility. It has an indoor sports complex that has 2 indoor turf fields, 8 basketball courts, our own fitness center, a climbing mountain, and we have an adjacent on-campus driving range that is one of the best driving ranges that's open 12 months a year, indoor-outdoor hitting. So we are a destination for people to enjoy sports, have recreation fun. They can rent out the building. They can come and have fitness and other recreational things. In special events, we will have the Blackhawks coming for the Road Watch party for the 4th year in a row on Friday, April 4th.
What's that all about? Real quick.
We watch the Hawks play on the road on a big screen TV, and 500 Hawk fans gather to watch the Hawks play a road game, and it's a great event. You can buy tickets for it now, and it's a can't-miss thing. And we have a free throw contest going on now where fans can have a chance to test their free throw skills. And Jim, you are an expert free throw shooter during your days in Glen Ellen. We have that free throw contest going on, and we have an open house in our fitness center this Saturday from 9 to noon. So a lot going on. Come visit us at the corner of Peterson and Route 45.
Oh, Connie, it has just been wonderful. Thank you for taking us way back. So many wonderful stories about the Chicago Sting, the Chicago Cubs. We never did get to, like you said, the New Orleans Saints and so many other things, the Chicago Enforcer. I mean, we can go on and on, but really, really a pleasure. Thanks again.
You're welcome, Jim. Thanks for having me on the air.
Now, if you wish to contact Connie Kowal, you can contact him at www.libertyville.com.
Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.